raffle tickets when they mail in their membership, and we've had people from 9 different states buy tickets so far. So the furthest away was Florida. We've had some go to Arizona, so New York, so pretty interesting. As far as the, so yeah, get your tickets. Jeff's got some in the back today, or I've got some as well. If you'd like to sell some to your friends and family, let me know. I've got plenty with me. I can assign some out to you if you would like. Help us out to get those going. So really looking forward to that. And once again, appreciate the Boathouse for their continued support and partnershiping with us on this raffle. And we will draw that, what's it called, the Bike and Boat Show at the West Bank again this year in May. So on the shelter house, as most of you know, we raised the money for this playground. It's all paid for. We're working with BTF to get that installed, Van Tilburg Farms to get that installed. But we decided to expand the project and include a shelter house. So this will be where we put in the ADA fishing pier that you all were a part of. And so this will be right in front of that. And so we're going to put in a 24 by 36 shelter house as well. So if you drive down Lakeshore Drive and you look at those new shelter houses Linus put in recently, like by the hot water hole, it's going to be that same design. And so I ran the numbers on that this morning, and we have already had one donation from Cargill out of Sydney for about $6,600. And so our bogey on that is about $36,000 that we're going to try to attempt to raise here over the next month or so. Our goal, and it's a pretty hefty goal because we're into February today, right, is to build that, have that up and operational. The playground, the shelter house, all operational by Memorial Day is our goal. That's a pretty hefty goal, but we've got some partners. Another big partner is going to be the Grand Lake Rec Club in that project. So if you know any businesses or anybody that you think I could hit up to potentially help us fund that shelter house, let me know afterwards. So thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Brian. And I'll give an update on our other playground project we have. I mentioned it a couple of times, the All Abilities Playground that's going to go in the East Bank over by the first shelter house. That was funded in large part by the Auglaize County Board of Developmental Disabilities and also with a grant from Game Time, a matching grant. And when we first set out to do that, we had expected some additional funding that would come in and fund not just this core structure that you see there, but also some accessible swings. That funding fell through, and we had a deadline to meet to take advantage of that matching grant from Game Time. So we had submitted our order, and then shortly after that, Auglaize Board of Developmental Disabilities came and said, you know, we have a little bit of extra grant money if you could use it for the playground project. So we got with DWA and Game Time, and we were able to extend our deadline a little bit and add these swings you can see in the background there to it, and the LAA also kicked in some additional money. So that's going to be nice now that they have that core playground and the swings. Waiting on that to be delivered, looking for an install this year, but don't have a date on that yet. Next, I'll ask Jeff to come up and talk to us about Winter Icebreaker Dance and Fundraiser coming up 2 weeks from today.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to see everybody out this morning. The Winter Icebreaker, February 15th at Romer's. Naked Karate Girls will be our entertainment for the night. We'll have silent auction and a lot of things that we'll be raffling off that night. It's pretty interesting what we got. So Eldora tickets and a lot of fun stuff. So hope to see you guys there. If you want to get tickets, that's $20 a person. Some of us have some of those today. It's easiest just to go online and get those tickets. So if you go online, that way at that night, there'll be like a will call at the door. You'll be able to just to go there and grab your tickets and enjoy the night. Corporate tables for 10 people and 40 drink tokens are $500. We've got a lot of those already sold. Ticket sales right now, we're probably a little over 300 tickets sold, and we're probably going to go 550 tickets, so more than half the tickets are already sold. So get your tickets, don't wait around if you're planning to go, and figure out who's going to be in your group and look at a group table, so you'll have a lot of fun with that. That's all I got. Any questions?
Thanks, Jeff.
It was easy.
Thanks, Jeff. And I'll just add, if you know anybody that might have a cool silent auction item, just get a hold of me, and I would love to get in touch with them. I'll give you a quick membership update. We still have several mailed-in renewals that haven't been entered into the system yet. We should be all caught up shortly. But if you got an email that says you need to renew and you mailed in your renewal, you can just ignore that. It says that in the email, but we've had a small handful of people who just didn't see that message and got a hold of us this week. So rest assured, if you've sent it, we have it. We'll get it sent, entered in, and then probably next month, I should have updates on the numbers. And your membership cards typically go out toward the end of March. We receive those around the beginning of April or so. Something else we recently did, the state park asked us to help fund the rebuild of some picnic tables. So we are supplying the lumber for 48 picnic tables at the state park. The tables were in pretty bad shape. So funding those helps us ensure that our park's amenities look nice and are usable. The cost on that was $1,824. We're also have ordered the cornhole boards I've referenced before. This is just the design, obviously not the picture of the board because they're not here yet, but they'll be blue with the LA logo on them. Those are going over Sunset Beach, so people who like to play cornhole and go out there, they don't need to drag their boards out. They can just bring their bags. If you haven't seen it, the new Grand Lake Travel, Grand Lake CVB Travel Planner is out. I want to commend Matt Stogler, their new director. He reimagined this year, and I think he really did a fantastic job. You can pick one up at the visitor center and various locations in the area. But if you look on the back, the LAA takes that up. We put an ad there to promote our app. And then on page 13, we're promoting our upcoming events this year. So I think that's good for people who are visiting the area to see our app because we list lake events and hotspots, so that can help people get around. And then yesterday, the Daily Standard put out its progress report. If you haven't seen that, if you have a copy of the Standard, they did a nice big spread about the LAA in that. I will point out they mentioned that we're a 501c3, but we're not. We're a C4. That's an important distinction. But otherwise, I think it was a pretty good article. Next, I'll ask State Park Manager David Fahler to come up and give us a State Park update.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good.
It seems very quiet this morning. Lake level is currently -6 inches, up from -13 inches in December. And December of 2023 was -14.6, and December of 2022 was -18.25. Rainfall for January, this is not including Thursday night through today's rain. My wife had a procedure, so I've been very busy with her, helping her out. And so I came in this morning hoping that I could check the rainfall, and it's frozen in a big stainless steel container, so I can't dump it over to the park where you read the gauge. So I don't know what we got. It does look pretty significant. Like, it may double what we've had so far, which is only 0.74 inches so far for the year. This does kind of scare me, because what I've noticed over my years is our rainfalls kind of follow a pattern. And you look in December and in January, our rainfall's not real good. So, and just to let you know, the rainfall for 2024 was 34.54 inches. Down 5.4 inches from our normal average of 45 inches. 2023 was 31.99, down from 13.01 inches from normal. Camp, we have Memorial Day, Juneteenth, and 4th of July are all full, and then there's like 4 weekends as well so far that's already filled up.
We do have some non-electric sites available on those holiday weekends. I left my glasses in the truck. It's killing me here. So if I can hold this for me. So there is 6 sites available left for 4th of July weekend and non-electric. And then my public service update. We've had some really good cold weather this year. I'm sure Stephen will go over how great and how much that benefits the lake. But we also had several days of warm weather and we had rain. So that ice is very, very iffy. Brian Miller and I went out around the lake on Monday. Last Friday when I left, there was an area about, I'm going to say, 100 yards long and 15 feet wide down at West Beach area or Sunset Beach area. And when we went on Monday out, that had to be probably closer to a quarter mile long, if not a half mile long, and about probably 100 feet wide. So it's thawing out. So please, if you go out on the ice, I used to be an ice fisherman, I know the draw, just please make sure that you have ice picks to pull yourself out and be extremely, extremely careful. And don't forget, you get around any hard structure, especially that's dark. When the sun hits that, it thaws that area out, including the bank. So please be very careful. I am very excited. I came to Brian last year about this All Abilities Playground, and that is all falling together real well in what, Brian, about 11 months, I'd say?
Something like that, yeah.
And this group is a huge supporter. I mean, he doesn't quite emphasize what it is, but if there was no one to receive that grant and take that grant and from the Board of DD, take that grant and roll it over to a grant to Game Time, this would not have happened. So I just have the idea and know the people to talk to try and make things like this happen. So just a major thank you to the LIA for this. And this is a very lofty goal, but I really hope to do the ribbon cutting on this park for the ADA fishing derby that you guys put out in September. So hopefully that'll happen. Also finished Kent Chainer and the Chen Brothers finished up the ADA dock where Rob Heckler, my NRT supervisor, installed as an Eagle Scout there at West Bank. So some of the things that have been going on, and that's pretty much my update. Does anybody have any questions for me?
How thick was that ice, would you suspect? You guys checked it out.
So I've heard anywhere from 9 to 13 inches. But this lake, I've never fished this lake because I know what this lake is. And it is huge. The wind just screams across it. I mean, we had a day last week that it was like 42 degrees and sunny, but the wind was blowing so bad that ODOT never stopped running up and down 364 because the wind was taking that little bit of snow that was on the lake and blowing it across 364 between the Bulkhead and Otterbein. And then I also know that there are all kinds of springs or just water currents out there that keep the lake open too. To me, this lake is very scary when it comes to trying trusting ice on it. Yeah?
One other question. Is there any progress on the hydroplane situation?
I have not heard any progress on it. Yes?
Just a back on your campground sites. How many total campground sites are there?
We have 208. We have 208 campsites and we have 7 cabins.
And what was the total, or the annual total rainfall average?
Annual total rainfall average is 45 inches. And then last year we got 34.54 inches. Any other questions? Good enough, thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Just something else Jeff Vossler wanted to say really quick. Jeff, do you mind?
Thanks, Ryan. As you all know, we got Dr. Jackman with us here today, and he's the head of the lab that does a lot of research and stuff for us. Well, there's a lot of students and stuff that do a lot of the work behind the scenes, and we're happy to have Mary Ramp with us today. Mary donated $1,000 towards a scholarship to help us with those students. Layton Pruitt is also going to do 2 scholarships, so we're going to do 3 scholarships to the lab personnel, whatever, who helped Dr. J capture the information about our lake. So that will be coming soon. Thank you, Mary.
Thanks, Jeff, and thank you, Mary. And next, I'll ask Dr. Jackman to come up and give us a report on the watershed in 2024.
Thank you very much, Brian. And I'll start by saying thank you again for contributing to those scholarships for our students over there at Lake Campus that are interested in environmental science. It's a wonderful thing. You know, I'm so proud to teach at the Lake Campus. It's one of the most affordable quality state educations that you'll find anywhere. I'm very proud to be a part of that, and it's just so nice to see groups like this and people like this helping out even more and helping make sure that that our students can pursue their educational goals. So big thank you. None of the things that I get to present about to y'all would be possible without those students working year-round in the wind, in the rain, in the cold out there collecting water samples. So it's just that's nice to see things like this. So thank you. My goal today is to go over kind of the past year review. So today is all about looking at 2024 and kind of taking stock of what that actually looked like now that it's done. To begin with, 2024, it was a low flow year. It was a low flow year in all of the creeks, and obviously that's precipitation based. What's interesting about 2024 and perhaps some more recent years of memory, but what's interesting is it's not necessarily the quantity of precipitation, although we were down a little bit, but it's not always the quantity of precipitation. It becomes a timing issue. You know, we had a tremendous amount of rain in April, and just really minimal rain many other times, most of the times throughout the year. And so the quantity of rain for the entire year may not be that drastically different, but the actual timing of it was massively different. These precipitation events obviously start it all, right? They fuel the flows into the tributaries, which fuels the water going into the lake. So to talk about the actual lake health and talk about the watershed health, we really have to start by talking about the flows, talking about water. If you look at the long-term monitoring in terms of how much water is actually in our streams and Grand Lake watershed, if you look at the actual daily discharge in any given month, what you're going to find is that April was the only month with higher than average flows. So if you look at the average number of gallons in a particular river on a particular day during a particular month, April's the only month in which the average was up. And we've been looking at this data for a long time. So if you look at the previous 10-year average, the month of April, you had about 21 million gallons a day in Chickasaw Creek. That's what you could expect flowing through there. This past year, 2024, it's about 53 million gallons a day. So 2.5x. But beyond that, that's it. There was another month in there that was about equivalent, but everything else was low. And it was really, really low. In fact, some months were 5% of what you would expect. You know, so if you normally expect 100 gallons a day moving through there, you'd get 5. So it's really huge drops in the amount of water moving through in many of the months. I've got the data set up there. You guys can feel free to check out the LIA website. This will get posted here shortly, and you can scroll through all the data to your heart's content. But that was the flow conditions for the year. Obviously, those flows, as much as we possibly can, we like to move those flows through wetlands. Much of the year, those flows are extremely nutrient-rich, so we like to move those through the wetlands. We like to use those wetlands to filter out those nutrients. So how did the wetlands do this year? All total, the wetlands captured the equivalent of about 625 million gallons. Coldwater Creek, far and away, was responsible for the majority of that, followed by Prairie Creek and Beaver Creek, and a surprising start with Big Chickasaw. In all, Coldwater Creek effectively processed about 15% of the annual stream flow, which means 15% of every drop of water that moved through Coldwater Creek, the equivalent of that moved through the wetlands. That's a big number. That's a huge number. Prairie Creek, about 6%. Beaver Creek, about 3%. And Big Chickasaw Creek, about 2%. All total, again, these wetlands filtered, processed about 625 million total gallons. We expect those numbers to go up for Prairie Creek quite a bit next year. Prairie Creek ran at maybe, you know, quarter capacity this whole year. It's been struggling the last couple of years. There've been some issues with impellers on pumps and issues with sand in the intakes, and so we're working on a sump system to try and settle some things out before it ever moves into the wetland. And hopefully with those renovations that are expected before the start of this year's flow season, hopefully before April, before May, we can have that done, and Prairie Creek's flow should double, triple, maybe even quadruple compared to last year. That'll be a great thing to see. Big Chickasaw Creek, this is first year in operation. We weren't expecting to move any water through that site. We were expecting to keep it wet and see how the veg took off. But that particular site was situated on a legacy seed bank. There were a lot of plants that were just waiting in the soil, just waiting for water and anoxic conditions in the soil. That's perfect for a wetland. And these seeds were just waiting. And once it got that, they took off like crazy. There were some intentional plantings down out there at Big Chickasaw, and that certainly augmented and improved the diversity of plant life out there. But there was a great seed bank, tremendous seed bank, that really took off out there. As a consequence of that, when the wetland was, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months old, I mean, it really looked and behaved like 4 or 5 year old wetland. So we turned the pumps on midway through the summer. Said, okay, this thing is ready to go. Let's see what it can do. Didn't turn them on full bore. There's two pumps out at Big Chick. And so we turned on one this past year. Not wanting to poke the bear too much, but it was exciting. As a consequence of that, again, Big Chickasaw was projected to process 0 gallons this past year, and it moved 2% of the flows of the Big Chickasaw Creek. And, that's only pumping for a couple of months and only one of two pumps. So hopefully, we've got big plans for that next year. Did so well this year. We'll turn them both on and see what we can happen. We'll see what can happen. How the water do once it moved through our actual wetlands? It depends on the season, but overall, three-quarter of the nutrients that were in the water, or the sediment that was in the water, was reduced. So we saw nutrient reductions up to 67, 75, 90% in some cases. I mean, these are great reductions. None of these are negative. None of these are a bad thing. We saw some awesome, awesome things. Again, with these wetlands, the water comes in extremely nutrient-rich, and it leaves very nutrient-poor. That's a great thing because that takes away the fuel from the harmful algal bloom that we'll talk about here in a minute. It takes away the fuel from the harmful algal bloom that's out there in the lake itself. When you look at the concentration difference between the inflows and the outflows, and then you multiply that by the total number of gallons that actually moved through the wetlands, you get this load statistic. We've talked about this a lot. Load is simply the, if you held it in your hand, how much of the thing that you're trying to reduce, how much of that thing did you reduce? Well, we reduced quite a bit. You need some pretty big hands to hold these. In terms of just dirt, sediment, 121,000 pounds were reduced between the four wetlands that we're talking about, between Coldwater Creek, Beaver Creek, Prairie Creek, and Big Chickasaw Creek. 121,000 pounds. In terms of pure elemental phosphorus, around 950 or 1,000 pounds of phosphorus. A little over a third of that was soluble phosphorus, which is some of the most challenging nutrients around there to take care of. Relative to nitrogen, you know, up to 21,000 total pounds of pure nitrogen was removed from the water before it ever got to Grand Lake, and this is you know, just phenomenal. The document that's going to be on the LIA website soon, and the document that is in front of you, kind of takes you through and gives you something to hold and gives you something to look at. You know, if we went through every line in this, we'd be here for hours. We need to order takeout, but I wanted everybody to have this again, just like every year, so that you had the actual data, you had close to the raw data, so that you could really look at how well these wetlands are performing in the context of kind of why we need these, and then also in the context of why we need more of these natural systems. So this is a great thing, and all the individual wetland data is all in here, so you can see that. Right now I'm sort of speaking over all the wetlands, but this dives into all four of our wetlands, a deep dive from throughout the past year. The goal is to reduce nutrients, to reduce the harmful algal bloom. And so with that, let's chat about the algal toxin levels, total microcystin toxin. This pretty closely tracks the biomass of the algae as well, as we've talked about before, but the actual number of harmful algal cells from the cyanobacteria. Primarily, this was a planktothrix year, which is a very typical alga for Grand Lake. It's very rare that we see the biomass dominated by anything other than planktothrix. This planktothrix can produce toxins, and it has produced toxins for a long time over the years. The great folks over at the Salina Water Treatment Plant have maintained a data set from the intake area over by the Salina Lighthouse, right over here down the road. They've maintained a phenomenal database of the toxin levels for over the past decade, and we've been able to sort of synthesize that, and that's what you see here. When you look at 2024 and you ask, how's it compare to the last 15 years or so, how's it compare to the average between 2009 and 2023? What you'll see is that for the fall, we had microcystin values about 60% less than the average. For the spring, 50% less. For the summer, 50% less. For the winter, 75% less than what you'd expect. How do these numbers compare to, you know, thresholds and cutoff points from this agency or that agency? Pretty well, extremely well in terms of the seasonal averages. There's a lot of different organizations out there that issue microcystin toxin advisory limits, and there's a lot of different ways to slice those advisory limits. Sometimes those advisory limits are recreation for young, healthy adults. Sometimes those advisory limits are, you know, catered towards, you know, someone that may be immunocompromised or something like that. So there's a lot of different ways to slice that, which is why when you look for total microcystin advisory levels, you'll see, you know, World Health Organization has, you know, four or five or six different categories and different thresholds. And you'll see that the state of Ohio has a single threshold. The idea of that single threshold is to try and, you know, the idea is to not be confusing, to not have five or six different levels that you have to sort of sift through. But that's why when you look at those different organizations, whether it's the Ohio Department of Health or whether it's, you know, the World Health Organization or whether it's, you know, the state of Michigan or what have you, when you look at those different levels, that's why those different levels exist. Comparing our data to the recreational threshold set by the WHO, our seasonal averages were all below that threshold. That dotted line on top, the text is a little bit small, but the red dotted line that's going left to right in the screen, that red dotted line is the advisory for the recreational limit. And you can see the solid black line that represents our weekly testing data, that represents the water treatment plant's weekly testing data and our synthesis of it. You can see there's really only a couple of weeks that are above it, and there's only one week that's, you know, egregiously above that. Everything else is below that, sometimes well below that. Perhaps even more exciting, though, rather than comparing us to a benchmark like that, is to compare us to ourselves from past years. The dotted black line represents the 10-12-year average. How do we stack up against the decadal average data set? The answer is we stack up extremely well. We only had 1 week out of the year where we were above that average, and it was, you know, an anomalous week. That was a week wherein we'd had a lot of spring rain right before that week. That was that sort of strange midsummer storm we had. And there were a lot of nutrients that washed into the lake all at once. And it was extremely warm, and the growing conditions were just right. And so once we got that slug of nutrients, things, you know, peaked up for a brief amount of time. And then they came back down, thankfully. But again, you can see we're below the average, and that's the goal every single year, to stay below that. Now, if you're comparing yourself to the average for every single year you're below that average, the next year gets even harder to meet that benchmark. We have, you know, for the last 4 or 5 years been consistently below the average. And so hopefully next year we'll be below the average again, but it's going to be harder to get there, and it's going to keep getting harder. It's going to keep getting harder, the better and better that things get. Hopefully that's not discouraging if there's a week or two that are sort of blips or anomalous, but it should show everyone a good deal of encouragement. You know, the water quality in Grand Lake is not perfect. It is not pristine. It is not a glacial lake from high in the mountains, but it's better than what it was. It's a lot better than what it was, and we understand the path to continue to make it better. We got an obligation to each other to do that, so that's what we'll do. Moving forward from a kind of wetland conservation perspective, the big goals, we had 625 million gallons flow through the wetlands in 2024. It'd be great, just because it's a nice round number, if we could get a billion. I mean, that's a nice round number. There's nothing scientific about a billion, except that it is more than 625 million. So there's that. Anyway, it'd be great to see that. I'd love to see, that billion mark. And I think with the improvements to Prairie Creek and the uptick in pump activity at Big Chickasaw Creek, just because that site did so well last year, knock on wood, like it's possible. We could do that. It'd be great to see. And again, every single gallon that moves through these wetlands is a gallon that doesn't go straight into the lake. And these wetlands work, and they work really well. And so this is an easy thing to talk about, an easy thing to convey. I get to stand up here and give good news. And I appreciate everybody's attention. I'll open up for questions if you got them. Thank you. All right. Okay.
As far as the running these pumps, the electrical cues and that, who pays for that? Is that going through the lake improvement, or who pays for that?
Yeah, so the electricity for the pumps are not free. They do run. That's pumped, or those electrical bills. And Dave, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if you're still here, but there's a memorandum of understanding between the Lake Facilities Authority and the ODNR. And the ODNR is the one that ultimately ends up paying for the electricity on the majority of those pumps. Beaver Creek, I believe, is paid by the county. Is that correct, Brian?
Correct.
Is everything I said been correct so far?
I think so.
Okay. So that's where that electricity comes from.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to, it looks like there's a question that popped in online. Thank you, Brian. It was a question about lake ice. And again, parallels kind of what Dave was talking about. But there was a question that came in online about why certain areas of the lake, you know, freeze with 3-4 inches of ice. And then there's certain areas of the lake, when you got 3 or 4 inches of ice over here, there's certain areas that may be, you know, potentially wide open. You can see, you can see no ice. In particular, there was a spot, looks like the person asking the question is talking about a spot in the middle of the lake from a couple of weeks ago or a week ago when everything was really cold, and yet there was that spot. The question is, why is that spot there? Why is there a spot of the lake that's unfrozen? And the formation of lake ice, it's not terribly complicated. It's just cold, right? You just have to get below freezing. But the more ice that accumulates on a lake, the last spot to freeze, it becomes increasingly difficult for that last little spot to freeze. It has to be cold for a very, very long time. We just didn't seem to hit that threshold. We've certainly had the lake completely frozen over at times, but we didn't quite hit that this year. Now, why is that? Well, as the ice begins to encroach, a lake like Grand Lake has a very large fetch area. It's got a very large surface area for wind to blow across. And so that last spot to freeze, it becomes really challenging because the water is getting hit by the wind, and any sort of ice that attempts to accumulate and aggregate, it can get blown around. The other thing that can sometimes happen is the surface, the ice, is colder than the water that's in the deepest part of the lake. It's colder than the water that's, you know, 5, 6, 10 feet below the surface, right? And that's a good thing, because if it wasn't, that would mean ice didn't float. And that would be a problem for our lake, for every lake. But what ends up happening is, if there's any kind of movement of the water column, sometimes you can have spots, for whatever reason, maybe it's the wind blowing, it could be pressure from the ice, it could be pushing from some other place in the lake. But if you have some of that bottom water that ends up moving in an upward direction, it can prevent that surface water from freezing solid. Again, nothing's going to prevent the lake from freezing solid when you've got, you know, the kind of winter like we had 3 or 4 years ago when we saw it freezing solid. But this year, we just didn't quite, knock on wood, there's still time, but we just didn't quite get enough cold days, frigid days, to sort of take out that last little bit. Sometimes there's a tendency to think about, like, you know, is there something going on? Is there something weird down there that, you know, somebody should look at? Like, you know, you think about a lake like Grand Lake and with a bunch of oil derricks a long time ago. So we thought, you know, is there something like that down there? Something that's uncapped or something weird? Or is there, you know, some sort of strange natural spring occurrence? You know, there are some natural springs out there, but nothing that's going to move enough water to do that. And in terms of an oil derrick leaking in the middle of the lake, there would be plenty of other signs and symptoms. You'd see the crude sort of floating around up there, right? So it's unlikely to be those things. But again, I didn't walk out there. I didn't jump in. But unlikely to be those. The more likely explanation is that it just wasn't quite cold enough. And that last little bit of a lake that's the last to freeze requires much more energy or effort, if you want to think about it like that, than the first bits to freeze. So I thought that was that's a good question. Clearly, there were some people chatting about that online. I think there were a couple of questions about that.
In non-packed biology.
What's that?
Was she asking if algae had any impact on?
Oh, yeah. That was the last part. The other part of that question was sort of, you know, could algae have any impact on that? The answer is no. There's not a lot of algae in the water column right now. This time of year, a place like Grand Lake, what ends up happening is a lot of the algae either dies or goes dormant and sort of sinks down to the bottom and sort of stays down there. When we take our water samples and we assess biomass, the levels of chlorophyll, which is a measurement of biomass, the levels of chlorophyll can be up to 400 micrograms per liter during the summer. Right now, we're getting readings that are about 20, 15. So it's almost not there in that water column. And then during the spring and summer when things warm up, those cyanobacteria have the ability to migrate vertically through the water column. So they can raise up from sort of dormant spots, and then they can proliferate from there. Yeah?
Yeah, are there any additional opportunities for expanding wetlands or getting saturated?
Yeah, so the question was, are there any opportunities for additional wetlands? And I see Jeff back there. Jeff?
Oh yeah, I'm gnawing at the bit. Next month, you're gonna have Teresa Dirksen here. Teresa's gonna be able to give you some good news about some funding opportunities that we landed to acquire more land for wetland, for wetlands.
There it is. That's great news. Yes, Teresa Dirksen will be here next month to chat about wetlands, additional wetlands moving into the watershed, and that's great. In terms of how much of the watershed is a wetland, and, you know, could you possibly fit any more in here? We really don't have. I mean, we have a lot, and we've certainly grown in terms of the number of wetlands, but because of where we started about 20 years ago, you know, if you look at the number of wetlands that were present in Grand Lake St. Mary's in the 1700s, based on old land survey data, about a third of the watershed was wetland habitat. By the 90s, that number had dropped to less than 0.5%. So, like, almost completely gone. Almost completely gone. And then over the last decade or so, there's been close to 1,000 acres of wetland restored. This equates to somewhere in the ballpark of about 2.5%. About 2% of the watershed would be considered wetland habitat. And so is there room for expansion and additional wetlands? Absolutely. But you got to be smart about them, right? You don't want to put a wetland right in the middle of downtown Salina. You know, put them in the right spots. But as those spots come up, even small wetlands can make a big difference, both in nutrients as well as habitat for wildlife. Most of our wetlands now that are pump systems, they're all downstream, which is where you would want a pumped wetland to be so that you had enough water to operate the pump, you know, year round. But in terms of future expansion, where would you want to put more wetlands? Well, if at the mouth of the creeks, where the creeks meet the lake, if you've got wetlands dotted all the streams, that's great. That's a great start. Where else could you go? You could move upstream. You could move upstream, and perhaps those would not be pump systems. Maybe they would be stream-side riparian systems that were sort of dug out along the banks, and when the creek rose, water could just sort of passively flow into that. That would be a great option. The other option, moving upstream, would be stream restoration. You know, if you look at the golf course, Jeff, do you remember the name of the golf course?
Elks.
The Elks Golf Course. I kept wanting to say the Beaver Creek Golf Course. No, the Elks Golf Course, it's kind of down the road on 127 over by the seminary. The Elks Golf Course right on Beaver Creek, an awesome example of a really far-reaching stream restoration project. And so in terms of expanding efforts, conservation efforts, is there more room? You know, absolutely, there's always more room. And if there is a room for a wetland, there's room to renovate the stream channels and improve natural habitat. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Jackman. Really cannot overstate how fortunate we are that Dr. Jackman shares his expertise and time and energy with us. If you're in, or we're in on those directors' meetings every month, and he brings the science to the table. So when we're talking to the directors, there's that authoritative voice there. So what he's doing and what Therese has been doing too, bring these wetlands back to Grand Lake, we can see it's working. We have the numbers that show it's working. Obviously, more to do, but really commend them for their efforts and appreciate it. Just a couple more things. I want to bring up our March meeting, March 1st, I believe. We're going to have Dr. Chuck Sabaglio from Wright State out here. He's a professor of earth science and paleontology. He's going to be discussing the geologic history of the area from the Silurian seas 420 million years ago through the Pleistocene ice ages. This will include the bedrock below our feet, the mineral resources, and our surface features such as soils and Grand Lake. So if you've ever wondered what was here before Grand Lake, next month is the time to come and find that out. It's really a can't miss presentation. The last thing I have is the 50-50.
I'm going to ask Mrs. Miller here to pull the claim ticket for us. And I'm sure she can bark
the numbers out loudly. 516-7845. 7845.
And
Claire's
going to get
$24. Got Dylan over here. For $24.
Keep it.
He says to keep it. Thank you very much.
$48, so we can donate it back. $48.
We got $48 out of that. Thank you very much. All right.